time from his official calling. But there was no organized colonization and settlement. English authority was accepted in the Norse towns on the southern and eastern coast, and the King's writ ran over a varying area of country surrounding Dublin. This hinterland of the capital was significantly known as the Pale, which might be defined as a defended enclosure. Immediately outside lay the big feudal lordships, and beyond these were the wild, unconquered Irish of the West. Two races dwelt in uneasy balance, and the division between them was sharpened when a Parliament of Ireland evolved towards the end of the 13th century. From this body, the native Irish were excluded. It was a Parliament in Ireland for the Anglo-Irish only. Within a few generations of the coming of the Anglo-Normans, however, the Irish chieftains began to recover from the shock of new methods of warfare. They hired mercenaries to help them, originally in large part recruited from the North's Celtic stock of the Scottish Western Isles. These were the terrible Gallowglasses, named from the Irish words for foreign henchmen. Supported by these ferocious axe-bearers, the clan chiefs regained for the Gaelic-speaking peoples wide regions of Ireland, and might have won more had they not incessantly quarrelled among themselves. Meanwhile, a change of spirit had overtaken many of the Anglo-Norman Irish barons. These great feudatories were constantly tempted by the independent role of the Gaelic clan chief that was theirs for the taking. They could in turn be subjects of the English king, or petty kings themselves, like their new Celtic allies, with whom they were frequently united by marriage. Their stock was seldom reinforced from England, except by English lords who wedded Irish heiresses and then became absentee landlords. Gradually a group of Anglo-Irish nobles grew up, largely assimilated to their adopted land, and as impatient as their Gaelic peasants of rule from London. If English kings had regularly visited Ireland, or regularly appointed royal princes as resident lieutenants, the ties between the two countries might have been closely and honourably woven together. As it was, when the English king was strong, English laws generally made headway. Otherwise a loose Celtic anarchy prevailed. King John, in his furious, fitful energy, twice went to Ireland, and twice brought the quarrelsome Norman barons and Irish chiefs under his suzerainty. Although Edward I never landed in Ireland, English authority was then in the ascendant. Thereafter, the Gaels revived. The shining example of Scotland was not lost upon them. The brother of the victor of Bannockburn, Edward Bruce, was called in by his relations among the Irish chiefs with an army of Scottish veterans. He was crowned King of Ireland in 1316, but after a temporary triumph, and in spite of the aid of his brother, was defeated and slain at Dundalk. Thus Ireland did not break loose from the English crown and gain independence under a Scottish dynasty. But the victory of English arms did not mean a victory for English law, custom or speech. The Gaelic reaction gathered force. In Ulster, the O'Neills gradually won the mastery of Tyrone. In Ulster and Connaught, the feudal trappings were openly discarded when the line of the de Burr Earls of Ulster ended in 1333 with a girl. According to feudal law, she succeeded to the whole inheritance and was the king's ward to be married at his choice. In fact, she was married to Edward III's second son, Lionel of Clarence. But in Celtic law, women could not succeed to the chieftainship. The leading male members of the cadet branches of the de Burr family accordingly went Irish, snatched what they could of the inheritance, and assumed the clan name of Burke, or, after their founder, MacWilliam. They openly defied the government in Ulster and Connaught. In the western province, both French and Irish were spoken, but not English, and English authority vanished from these outer parts. To preserve the English character of the Pale, and of its surrounding Anglo-Norman lordships, a parliament was summoned in the middle of the 14th century. Its purpose was to prevent the English from going Irish, and to compel men of Irish race in the English-held parts of Ireland to conform to English ways. But its enactments had little effect. In the Pale, The old Norman settlers clung to their privileged position and opposed all attempts by the representatives of the Crown to bring the mere Irish under the protection of the English laws and institutions. Most of Ireland, by now, lay outside the Pale, either under native chiefs who had practically no dealings with the representatives of the English kings, or controlled by Norman dynasts, such as the two branches of the Fitzgeralds, who were earls or clan chiefs, as suited them best. English authority stifled the creation of either a native or a Norman centre of authority, and the absentee Lord of Ireland in London could not provide a substitute, nor even prevent his own colonists from intermingling with the population. By Tudor times, anarchic Ireland lay open to reconquest, and to the tribulations of reimposing English royal authority was to be added, after Henry VIII's Reformation, the fateful divisions of religious belief. Chapter 13. The Longbow. It seemed that the strong blood of Edward I had but slumbered in his degenerate son, for in Edward III England once more found leadership equal to her steadily growing strength. Beneath the squalid surface of Edward II's reign, there had nonetheless proceeded in England a marked growth of national power and prosperity. The feuds and vengeances of the nobility, the foppish vices of a weak king, had been confined to a very limited circle. The English people stood at this time possessed of a commanding weapon, the qualities of which were utterly unsuspected abroad. The longbow, handled by the well-trained archer class, brought into the field a yeoman type of soldier with whom there was nothing on the continent to compare. An English army now rested itself equally upon the armoured knighthood and the archers. The power of the longbow and the skill of the bowman had developed to a point where even the finest mail was no certain protection. At 250 yards, the arrow hail produced effects never reached again by infantry missiles at such a range until the American Civil War. The skilled archer was a professional soldier, earning and deserving high pay. He went to war often on a pony, but always with a considerable transport for his comfort and his arrows. He carried with him a heavy iron-pointed stake, which, planted in the ground, afforded a deadly obstacle to charging horses. Behind this shelter, a company of archers in open order could deliver a discharge of arrows so rapid, continuous, and penetrating as to annihilate the cavalry attack. Moreover, in all skirmishing and patrolling, the trained archer brought his man down at ranges which had never before been considered dangerous in the whole history of war. Of all this, the continent, and particularly France, our nearest neighbour, was ignorant. In France, the armoured knight and his men-at-arms had long exploited their ascendancy in war. The foot soldiers, who accompanied their armies, were regarded as the lowest type of auxiliary. A military caste had imposed itself upon society in virtue of physical and technical assertions which the coming of the longbow must disprove. The protracted wars of the two Edwards in the mountains of Wales and Scotland had taught the English many hard lessons, and although European warriors had from time to time shared in them, they'd neither measured nor imparted the secret of the new army. It was with a sense of unmeasured superiority that the English looked out upon Europe at the end of the first quarter of the 14th century. The reign of King Edward III passed through several distinct phases. In the first, he was a minor, and the land was ruled by his mother and her lover, Roger Mortimer. This government, founded upon unnatural murder and representing only a faction in the nobility, was condemned to weakness at home and abroad. Its rule of nearly 4 years was marked by concession and surrender, both in France and in Scotland. For this policy, many plausible arguments of peace and prudence might be advanced. The guilty couple paid their way by successive abandonments of English interests. A treaty with France in March 1327 condemned England to pay a war indemnity, and restricted the English possessions to a strip of land running from Saintes in Saintonge and Bordeaux to Bayonne, and to a defenceless enclave in the interior of Gascony. In May 1328, the shameful Treaty of Northampton, as it was called at the time, recognised Bruce as king north of the Tweed, and implied the abandonment of all the claims of Edward I in Scotland. The anger which these events excited was widespread. The regime might, however, have maintained itself for some time, but for Mortimer's quarrel with the barons. After the fall of the Despensers, Mortimer had taken care to put himself in the advantageous position they'd occupied on the Welsh border, where he could exercise the special powers of government appropriate to the marches. This, and his exorbitant authority, drew upon him the jealousies of the barons he had so lately led. His desire to make his position permanent caused him to seek from a parliament convened in October at Salisbury the title of Earl of March, in addition to the office he already held of Justice of Wales for life. Mortimer attended, backed by his armed retainers. But it then appeared that many of the leading nobles were absent, and among them Henry, Earl of Lancaster, brother of the executed Thomas and uncle of the King, who held a counter-meeting in London. From Salisbury, Mortimer, taking with him the young king, set forth in 1328 to ravage the lands of Lancaster, and in the disorders which followed, he succeeded in checking the revolt. It was plain that the barons themselves were too much divided to overthrow an odious but ruthless government. But Mortimer made an overweening mistake. In 1330, the king's uncle, the Earl of Kent, was deceived into thinking that Edward II was still alive. Kent made an ineffective attempt to restore him to liberty, and was executed in March of that year. This event convinced Henry of Lancaster and other magnates that it might be their turn to suffer next at Mortimer's hands. They decided to get their blow in first by joining Edward III. All eyes were therefore turned on the young king. When 15, in 1328, he'd been married to Philippa of Hainault. In June 1330, a son was born to him. He felt himself now a grown man who must do his duty by the realm. But effective power still rested with Mortimer and the Queen Mother. In October, Parliament sat at Nottingham. Mortimer and Isabella, guarded by ample force, were lodged in the castle. It's clear that very careful thought and preparation had marked the plans by which the king should assert his rights. Were he to succeed, Parliament was at hand to acclaim him. Mortimer and Isabella did not know the secrets of the castle. An underground passage led into its heart. Through this, on an October night, a small band of resolute men entered, surprised Mortimer in his chamber, which as usual was next to the Queen's, and, dragging them both along the subterranean way, delivered them to the King's officers. Mortimer, conducted to London, was brought before the peers, accused of the murder in Berkeley Castle and other crimes, and after condemnation by the Lords, hanged on November the 29th. Isabella was consigned by her son to perpetual captivity. £3,000 a year was provided for her maintenance at various country manors, and Edward made it his practice to pay her a periodic visit. She died nearly 30 years later. Upon these grim preliminaries, the long and famous reign began. The guiding spirit of the new king was to revive the policy, assert the claims, and restore the glories of his grandfather. The quarrel with Scotland was resumed. Since Bannockburn, Robert Bruce had reigned unchallenged in the north. His triumph had been followed inevitably by the ruin and expulsion of the adherents of the opposite Scottish party. Edward, the son of John Baliol, the nominee of Edward I, had become a refugee at the English court, which extended him the same kind of patronage afterwards vouchsafed by Louis XIV to the Jacobite exiles. No schism so violent as that between Bruce and Baliol could fail to produce rankling injuries. Large elements in Scotland after Bruce's death in 1329 looked to a reversal of fortune, and the exiles, or disinherited as they were termed, maintained a ceaseless intrigue in their own country and a constant pressure upon the English government. In 1332, an endeavour was made to regain Scotland. Edward Baliol rallied his adherents and, with the secret support of Edward III, sailed from Ravenspur to Kinghorn in Fife. Advancing on Perth, he met and defeated the infant David's regent at Duplin Moor. Balliol received the submission of many Scottish magnates and was crowned at Scone. Henceforward, fortune failed him. Within 2 months, he and his supporters were driven into England. Edward III was now able to make what terms he liked with the beaten Balliol. He was recognised by Balliol as his overlord and promised the town and shire of Berwick. In 1333, therefore, Edward III advanced to besiege Berwick and routed the Scots at Halidon Hill. This was a battle very different in character from Bannockburn. The power of the archers was allowed to play its part. The Chiltrons were broken, and the exiled party re-established for a while their authority in their native land. There was a price to pay. Balliol had to cede to the English king not only Berwickshire, but the whole of southeastern Scotland. In exacting this concession, Edward III had overshot the mark. He damned Balliol's cause in the eyes of all Scots. Meanwhile, the descendants and followers of Robert Bruce took refuge in France. The contacts between Scotland and France and the constant aid given by the French court to the Scottish enemies of England roused a deep antagonism. Thus the war in Scotland pointed the path to Flanders. Here a new set of grievances formed a substantial basis for a conflict. The loss of all the French possessions, except Gascony, and the constant bickering on the Gascon frontiers had been endured perforce since the days of John. Successive English kings had done homage in Paris for domains of which they had in large part long since been deprived. But in 1328, the death of Charles IV, without a direct heir, opened a further issue. Philip of Valois assumed the royal power and demanded homage from Edward, who made difficulties. King Edward III, in his mother's right, if indeed the female line was valid, had a remote claim to the throne of France. This claim, by and with the assent and advice of the Lords Spiritual and Temporal, and of the Commons of England, he was later to advance in support of his campaigns. The youthful Edward was less drawn to domestic politics than to foreign adventure and the chase. He was conscious, moreover, from the first, of the advantage to be gained by diverting the restless energies of his nobles from internal intrigues and rivalries to the unifying purpose of a foreign war. This was also in harmony with the temper of his people. The wars of John and Henry III on the mainland disclose a perpetual struggle between the king and his nobles and subjects to obtain men and money. European adventure was regarded as a matter mainly of interest to a prince concerned with his foreign possessions or claims. Now we see the picture of the estates of the realm becoming themselves ardently desirous of foreign conquests. Edward III did not have to wring support from his parliament for an expedition to France. On the contrary, nobles, merchants, and citizens vied with one another in pressing the crown to act. The dynastic and territorial disputes were reinforced by a less sentimental but nonetheless powerful motive, which made its appeal to many members of the Houses of Parliament. The wool trade with the Low Countries was the staple of English exports, and almost the sole form of wealth which rose above the resources of agriculture. The Flemish towns had attained a high economic development, based upon the art of weaving cloth, which they had brought to a remarkable perfection. They depended for their prosperity upon the wool of England. But the aristocracy, under the Counts of Flanders, nursed French sympathies, which recked little of the material well-being of the burghers, regarding them as dangerous and subversive folk whose growth in wealth and power conflicted with feudal ascendancy. There was therefore, for many years, a complete divergence, economic, social, and political, between the Flemish towns and the nobility of the Netherlands. The former looked to England, the latter to France. Repeated obstructions were placed by the Counts of Flanders upon the wool trade, and each aroused the anger of those concerned on both sides of the narrow sea. The mercantile element in the English Parliament, already inflamed by running sea fights with the French in the Channel, pleaded vehemently for action. In 1336, Edward was moved to retaliate in a decisive manner. He decreed an embargo on all exports of English wool, thus producing a furious crisis in the Netherlands. The townspeople rose against the feudal aristocracy, and under Jacques van Artevelde, a warlike merchant of Ghent, gained control, after a struggle of much severity, over a large part of the country. The victorious burghers, threatened by aristocratic and French revenge, looked to England for aid, and their appeals met with a hearty and deeply interested response. Thus all streams of profit and ambition flowed into a common channel, at a moment when the floodwaters of conscious military strength ran high, and in 1337, when Edward repudiated his grudging homage to Philip VI, the Hundred Years' War began. It was never to be concluded. No general peace treaty was signed, and not until the Peace of Amiens in 1802, when France was a republic and the French royal heir a refugee within these isles, did the English sovereign formally renounce his claims to the throne of the Valois and the Bourbons. Edward slowly assembled the expeditionary army of England. This was not a feudal levy, but a paid force of picked men. Its backbone consisted of indentured warriors, recruited where and how their captains pleased. In consequence, far less than the legal quota of unreliable militia needed to be drawn from every shire. Both knights and archers embodied the flower of the nation, and the men who gathered in the Cinque Ports formed one of the most formidable and efficient invading armies history had yet seen. These preparations were well known in France, and the whole strength of the monarchy was bent to resist them. Philip VI looked first to the sea. For many years there had been a warfare of privateers, and bitter hatred ruled between the maritime populations on both sides of the Channel. All the resources of the French marine were strained to produce a fleet. Even hired Genoese galleys appeared in the French harbours. In Normandy, plans were mooted for a counter-invasion, which should repeat the exploits of William the Conqueror. But Edward had not neglected the sea power. His interest in the navy won him from Parliament early in his reign the title of King of the Sea. He was able to marshal a fleet equal in vessels and superior in men. A great sea battle was necessary before the transport of the English army to France and its maintenance there was feasible. In the summer of 1340, the hostile navies met off Sluis, and a struggle of 9 hours ensued. "This battle," says Froissart, "was right furious and horrible, for battles by sea are more dangerous and fiercer than battles by land. For at sea there is no retreat or fleeing, there is no remedy but to fight and abide the fortune." The French admirals had been ordered under pain of death to prevent the invasion, and both sides fought well. But the French fleet was decisively beaten, and the command of the Channel passed into the hands of the invading power. The seas being now open, the army crossed to France. At Cadzand, the landing was opposed. Large bodies of Genoese crossbowmen and men-at-arms awaited the disembarkation. But the English archers, shooting from the ships at long range, cleared the shores and covered the invading troops. Joined with the revolted Flemings, Edward's numbers were greatly augmented, and this combined force, which may have exceeded 20,000, undertook the first Anglo-Flemish siege of Tournai. The city was stubbornly defended, and as the grip of famine tightened upon the garrison, the horrible spectacle was presented of the useless mouths being driven forth into no man's land to perish by inches without pity or relief. But the capture of this fortress was beyond Edward's resources in money and supplies. The power of the archers did not extend to stone walls. The first campaign of what was a great European war yielded no results, and a prolonged truce supervened. This truce was imposed upon the combatants through lack of money, and carried with it no reconciliation. On the contrary, both sides pursued their quarrel in secondary ways. The French wreaked their vengeance on the burghers of the Netherlands, whom they crushed utterly, and Van Artevelde met his death in a popular tumult at Ghent. The English retaliated as best they could. There was a disputed succession in Brittany, which they fomented with substantial aids. The chronic warfare on the frontiers of Gascony continued. Both sides looked forward to a new trial of strength. Well-trained men eager to fight there were in plenty, but to maintain them in the field required funds, which to us seem pitifully small, but without which all was stopped. How could these resources be obtained? The Jews had been exploited, pillaged, and expelled in 1290. The Florentine bankers, who'd found the money for the first invasion, had been ruined by royal default. The main effort, not only of the court, but of Parliament, was to secure the modest sums of ready money without which knights could not ride nor archers draw their bows. But here a fertile source was at hand. The wealthiest and best organised commercial interest in England, the wool trade, was eager to profit from war. A monopoly of wool merchants was created, bound to export only through a particular town to be prescribed by the king from time to time in accordance with his needs and judgment. This system, which was called the staple, gave the king a convenient and flexible control. By taxing the wool exports which passed through his hands at the staple port, he was assured of an important revenue independent of Parliament. Moreover, the wool merchants who held a monopoly formed a corporation interested in the war, dependent on the king, and capable of lending him money in return for considerate treatment. This development was not welcomed by Parliament, where the smaller wool merchants were increasingly represented. They complained of the favour shown to the monopolists of the staple, and they also pointed to the menace to parliamentary power involved in the king's independent resources. By the spring of 1346, Parliament had at length brought itself to the point of facing the taxation necessary to finance a new invasion. The army was reconstituted, more efficiently than before. Its old elements were refreshed with carefully chosen levies. In one wave, 2,400 cavalry, 12,000 archers and other infantry sailed and landed unopposed at Saint-Vaast in Normandy on July the 12th, 1346. Their object this time was no less than the capture of Paris by a sudden dash. The secret was well kept. Even the English army itself believed it was going to Gascony. The French could not for some time collect forces sufficient to arrest the inroad. Caen fell, and Edward advanced, burning and laying waste the whole country to the very walls of Paris. But by this time the whole power of the French monarchy had gathered against him. A huge force, which comprised all the chivalry of France, and was probably three times as big as Edward's army, assembled in the neighbourhood of Saint-Denis. Against such opposition, added to the walls of a fortified city, Edward's resources could not attempt to prevail. King Philip grimly invited him to choose upon which bank of the Seine he would fight a pitched battle. The thrust had failed, and retreat imposed itself upon the army. The challenger was forced to quit the lists at a pace which covered 60 miles in 4 days. The French army moved on a parallel line to the southward and denied the Seine Valley to the retreating English. They must now make for the Somme and hope to cross between Amiens and the sea. Our generation has become familiar with this stretch of the river, which flows through broad morasses. In those days, quite undrained and passable only by lengthy causeways and bridges. All these were broken or held by the levies of Picardy. 4 separate attempts to find a passage failed. The vanguard of the French main army was already at Amiens. Edward and the English host, which had tried so audacious, even foolhardy a spring, now seemed penned in a triangle between the Somme, the seashore, and the French mass. No means had been found to bring the fleet and its transport to any suitable harbour. To cross the Somme near the mouth was a desperate enterprise. The ford was very lengthy, and the tides, violent and treacherous, offered only a few precarious hours in any day. Moreover, the passage was itself defended by strong forces popularly estimated to have been upwards of 12,000 men. "The King of England," says Froissart, "did not sleep much that night, but rising at midnight ordered his trumpet to sound. Very soon everything was ready, and the baggage being loaded, they set out about daybreak and rode on until they came to the ford at sunrise. But the tide was at that time so full they could not cross." By the afternoon, at the ebb, the enemy's strength was manifest. But since to pause was to perish, the king ordered his marshals to plunge into the water and fight their way across. The French resistance was spirited. The knighthood of Picardy rowed out and encountered the English on the treacherous sands in the rising waters. They appeared to be as fond of tilting in the water as upon dry land. By hard fighting, under conditions most deadly to men encased in mail, the passage was forced. At the landing, the Genoese crossbowmen inflicted losses and delayed the deployment until the longbow asserted its mastery. Thus did King Edward's army escape. Philip, at the head of a host between 30,000 and 40,000 strong, was hard upon the track. He had every hope of bringing the insolent islanders to bay with their backs to the river, or catching them in transit. When he learned that they were already over, he called a council of war. His generals advised that, since the tide was now in, there was no choice but to ascend to Abbeville and cross by the bridge, which the French held there. To Abbeville they accordingly moved, and lay there for the night. Edward and his army were intensely convinced of the narrowness of their deliverance. That night they rejoiced. The countryside was full of food. The king gathered his chiefs to supper and afterwards to prayer. But it was certain that they could not gain the coast without a battle. No other resolve was open than to fight at enormous odds. The king and the Prince of Wales, afterwards famous as the Black Prince, received all the offices of religion, and Edward prayed that the impending battle should at least leave him unstripped of honour. With the daylight, he marshalled about 11,000 men in 3 divisions. Mounted upon a small palfrey, with a white wand in his hand, with his splendid surcoat of crimson and gold above his armour, he rode along the ranks, encouraging and entreating the army that they would guard his honour and defend his right. He spoke this so sweetly and with such a cheerful countenance that all who'd been dispirited were directly comforted by seeing and hearing him. They ate and drank at their ease and seated themselves on the ground, placing their helmets and bows before them, that they might be the fresher when their enemies should arrive. Their position on the open rolling downs enjoyed few advantages, but the forest of Cressy on their flanks afforded protection and the means of a final stand. King Philip, at sunrise on this same Saturday, August the 26th, 1346, heard Mass in the monastery of Abbeville, and his whole army, gigantic for those times, rolled forward in their long pursuit. 4 knights were sent forth to reconnoitre. About midday, the king, having arrived with large masses on the farther bank of the Somme, received their reports. The English were in battle array and meant to fight. He gave the sage counsel to halt for the day, bring up the rear, form the battle lines, and attack on the morrow. These orders were carried by famous chiefs to all parts of the army. But the thought of leaving, even for a day, this hated foe, who had for so many marches fled before overwhelming forces, and was now compelled to come to grips, was unendurable to the French army. What surety had they that the morrow might not see their enemies decamped and the field bare? It became impossible to control the forward movement. All the roads and tracks from Abbeville to Cressy were black and glittering with the marching columns. King Philip's orders were obeyed by some, rejected by most. While many great bodies halted obediently, still larger masses poured forward, forcing their way through the stationary or withdrawing troops, and at about 5 in the afternoon came face to face with the English army lying in full view on the broad slopes of Cressy. Here they stopped. King Philip, arriving on the scene, was carried away by the ardour of the throng around him. The sun was already low. Nevertheless, all were determined to engage. There was a corps of 6,000 Genoese crossbowmen in the van of the army. These were ordered to make their way through the masses of horsemen, and with their missiles break up the hostile array in preparation for the cavalry attacks. The Genoese had marched 18 miles in full battle order with their heavy weapons and store of bolts. Fatigued, they made it plain that they were in no condition to do much that day. But the Count of Alençon, who had covered the distance on horseback, did not accept this remonstrance kindly. "This is what one gets," he exclaimed, "by employing such scoundrels, who fall off when there is anything for them to do." Forward the Genoese. At this moment, while the crossbowmen were threading their way to the front under many scornful glances, dark clouds swept across the sun, and a short, drenching storm beat upon the hosts. A large flight of crows flew cawing through the air above the French in gloomy presage. The storm, after wetting the bowstrings of the Genoese, passed as quickly as it had come, and the setting sun shone brightly in their eyes and on the backs of the English. This, like the crows, was adverse, but it was more material. The Genoese, drawing out their array, gave a loud shout, advanced a few steps, shouted again, and a third time advanced, hooted, and discharged their bolts. Unbroken silence had wrapped the English lines, but at this the archers, 6,000 or 7,000 strong, ranged on both flanks in portcullis formation, who had hitherto stood motionless, advanced one step, drew their bows to the ear, and came into action. "They shot their arrows with such force and quickness," says Froissart, "that it seemed as if it snowed." The effect upon the Genoese was annihilating. At a range which their own weapons could not attain, they were in a few minutes killed by thousands. The ground was covered with feathered corpses. Reeling before this blast of missile destruction, the like of which had not been known in war, the survivors recoiled in rout upon the eager ranks of the French chivalry and men-at-arms, which stood just out of arrow-shot. "Kill me those scoundrels," cried King Philip in fury, "for they stop up our road without any reason." Whereupon the front line of the French cavalry rode among the retreating Genoese, cutting them down with their swords. In doing so, they came within the deadly distance. The arrow snowstorm beat upon them, piercing their mail and smiting horse and man. Valiant squadrons from behind rode forward into the welter, and upon all fell the arrow hail, making the horses caper and strewing the field with richly dressed warriors. A hideous disorder reigned. And now Welsh and Cornish light infantry, slipping through the checkered ranks of the archers, came forward with their long knives, and, falling upon earls, barons, knights and squires, slew many, at which the King of England was afterwards exasperated. Many a fine ransom was cast away in those improvident moments. In this slaughter fell King Philip's ally, the blind King of Bohemia, who bade his knights fasten their bridles to his, in order that he might strike a blow with his own hand. Thus entwined, he charged forward in the press. Man and horse they fell, and the next day their bodies were found still linked. His son, Prince Charles of Luxembourg, who as emperor-elect already signed his name as King of the Romans, was more prudent, and, seeing how matters lay, departed with his following by an unnoticed route. The main attack of the French now developed. The Count d'Alençon and the Count of Flanders led heavy cavalry charges upon the English line. Evading the archers as far as possible, they sought the men-at-arms, and French, German, and Savoyard squadrons actually reached the Prince of Wales's division. The enemy's numbers were so great that those who fought about the prince sent to the windmill, whence King Edward directed the battle, for reinforcements. But the king would not part with his reserves, saying, "Let the boy win his spurs," which in fact he did. Another incident was much regarded. One of Sir John of Hainault's knights, mounted upon a black horse, the gift that day of King Philip, escaping the arrows, actually rode right through the English lines. Such was their discipline that not a man stirred to harm him, and, riding round the rear, he returned eventually to the French army. Continuous cavalry charges were launched upon the English front until utter darkness fell upon the field. And all through the night, fresh troops of brave men, resolved not to quit the field without striking their blow, struggled forward, groping their way. All these were slain, for no quarter was the mood of the English, though by no means the wish of their king. When night had fallen, Philip found himself with no more than 60 knights in hand. He was slightly wounded by one arrow, and his horse had been shot under him by another. Sir John Hainault, mounting him again, seized his bridle and forced him from the field, upon the well-known principle which, according to Froissart, he exactly expounded, of living to fight another day. The king had but 5 barons with him on reaching Amiens the next morning. When, on this Saturday night, the English heard no more hooting or shouting, nor any more crying out to particular lords or their banners, They looked upon the field as their own, and their enemies as beaten. They made great fires and lighted torches because of the obscurity of the night. King Edward, who all that day had not put on his helmet, then came down from his post, and, with his whole battalion, advanced to the Prince of Wales, whom he embraced in his arms and kissed, and said, "Sweet son, God give you good perseverance. You are my son, for most loyally have you acquitted yourself this day. You are worthy to be a sovereign." The prince bowed down very low and humbled himself, giving all honour to the king, his father. On the Sunday morning, fog enshrouded the battlefield, and the king sent a strong force of 500 lances and 2,000 archers to learn what lay upon his front. These met the columns of the French rear, still marching up from Rouen to Beauvais in ignorance of the defeat, and fell upon them. After this engagement, the bodies of 1,542 knights and esquires were counted on the field. Later this force met with the troops of the Archbishop of Rouen and the Grand Prior of France, who were similarly unaware of the event, and were routed with much slaughter. They also found very large numbers of stragglers and wandering knights, and put to the sword all they met. "It has been assured to me for fact," says Froissart, "that of foot soldiers sent from the cities, towns, and municipalities, there were slain this Sunday morning 4 times as many as in the battle of the Saturday." This astounding victory of Crecy ranks with Blenheim, Waterloo, and the final advance in the last summer of the Great War as one of the 4 supreme achievements of the British Army. Edward marched through Montreuil and Etaples to Boulogne, passed through the forest of Ardeloo, and opened the siege of Calais. Calais presented itself to English eyes as the hive of that swarm of privateers who were the endless curse of the Channel. Here, on the nearest point of the continent, England had long felt a festering sore. Calais was what Dunkirk was to become 3 centuries later. The siege lasted for nearly a year. Every new art of war was practiced by land. The bombards flung cannonballs against the ramparts with terrifying noise. By sea, elaborate barriers of piles stopped the French light craft, which sought to evade the sea blockade by creeping along the coast. All reliefs by sea and land failed. But the effort of maintaining the siege strained the resources of the king to an extent we can hardly conceive. When the winter came, his soldiers demanded to go home, and the fleet was on the verge of mutiny. In England, everyone complained, and Parliament was morose in demeanour and reluctant in supply. The king and his army lived in their hutments, and during this time he never recrossed the Channel to his kingdom. Machiavelli has shrewdly observed that every fortress should be victualled for a year, and this precaution has covered almost every case in history. Moreover, the siege had hardly begun when King David of Scotland, in fulfilment of the alliance with France, led his army across the border. But the danger was foreseen, and at Neville's Cross, just west of the city of Durham, the English won a hard-fought battle. The Scottish king himself was captured and imprisoned in the Tower. He remained there, as we have seen, until released 11 years later for an enormous ransom. This decisive victory removed the Scottish danger for a generation. But more than once, before and after Flodden, the French alliance was to bring disaster to this small and audacious nation. Calais held out for 11 months, and yet this did not suffice. Famine at length left no choice to the besieged. They sued for terms. The king was so embittered that when, at his demand, 6 of the noblest citizens presented themselves in their shirts, barefoot, emaciated, he was for cutting off their heads. The warnings of his advisers that his fame would suffer in history by so cruel a deed left him obdurate. But Queen Philippa, great with child, who'd followed him to the war, fell down before him in an edifying and perhaps prearranged tableau of mercy pleading with justice. So the burghers of Calais, who had devoted themselves to save their people, were spared, and even kindly treated. Calais, then, was the fruit, and the sole territorial fruit so far, of the exertions, prodigious in quality, of the whole power of England in the war with France. But Cressy had a longer tale to tell. Chapter 14. The Black Death. While feats of arms and strong endeavours held the English mind, a far more deadly foe was marching across the continents to their doom. Christendom has no catastrophe equal to the Black Death. Vague tales are told of awful events in China, and of multitudes of corpses spreading their curse afar. The plague entered Europe through the Crimea, and in the course of 20 years destroyed at least one-third of its entire population. The privations of the people, resulting from ceaseless baronial and dynastic wars, presented an easy conquest to disease. The records in England tell more by their silence than by the shocking figures which confront us wherever records were kept. We read of lawsuits where all parties died before the cases could be heard, of monasteries where half the inmates perished, of dioceses where the surviving clergy could scarcely perform the last offices for their flocks and for their brethren, of the goldsmiths' company, which had 4 masters in a year. These are detailed indications, but far more convincing is the gap which opens in all the local annals of the nation. A whole generation is slashed through by a hideous severance. The character of the pestilence was appalling. The disease itself, with its frightful symptoms, the swift onset, the blotches, the hardening of the glands under the armpit or in the groin, these swellings which no poultice could resolve, these tumours which, when lanced, gave no relief, the horde of virulent carbuncles which followed the dread harbingers of death, the delirium, the insanity which attended its triumph, the blank spaces which opened on all sides in human society, stunned and for a time destroyed the life and faith of the world. The affliction, added to all the severities of the Middle Ages, was more than the human spirit could endure. The Church, smitten like the rest in body, was wounded grievously in spiritual power. If a God of mercy ruled the world, what sort of rule was this? Such was the challenging thought which swept upon the survivors. Weird sects sprang into existence, and plague-haunted cities saw the gruesome procession of flagellants, each lashing his forerunner to a dismal dirge, and ghoulish practices glare at us from the broken annals. It seemed to be the death-rattle of the race. But at length the plague abated its force, the tumours yielded to fomentations. Recoveries became more frequent, the resistant faculties of life revived. The will to live triumphed. The scourge passed, and a European population, too small for its clothes, heirs to much that had been prepared by more numerous hands, assuaging its griefs in their universality, turned with unconquerable hope to the day and to the morrow. Philosophers might suggest that there was no need for the use of the destructive mechanism of plague to procure the changes deemed necessary among men. A more scientific reagent was at hand. Gunpowder, which we have seen used in the puny bombards which, according to some authorities, Edward had fired at Cressy and against Calais, was soon decisively to establish itself as a practical factor in war and in human affairs based on war. If cannon had not been invented, the English mastery of the longbow might have carried them even farther in their continental domination. We know no reason why the yeoman archer should not have established a class position similar in authority to that of the armoured knights, but upon a far broader foundation. The early 15th century was to see the end of the rule of armoured men. Breastplates and backplates might long be worn as safeguards to life, but no longer as the instrument and symbol of power. If the archers faded, it was not because they could not master chivalry. A more convenient agency was at hand, which speedily became the common property of all nations. Amid jarring booms and billowing smoke, which frequently caused more alarm to friends than foes, but nonetheless arrested all attention, a system which had ruled and also guided Christendom for 500 years, and had in its day been the instrument of an immense advance in human government and stature, fell into ruins. These were painfully carted away to make room for new building. The calamity which fell upon mankind reduced their numbers and darkened their existence without abating their quarrels. The war between England and France continued in a broken fashion, and the Black Prince, the most renowned warrior in Europe, became a freebooter. Grave reasons of state had been adduced for Edward's invasion of France in 1338, but the character of the Black Prince's forays in Aquitaine can vaunt no such excuses. Nevertheless, they produced a brilliant military episode. In 1355, King Edward obtained from Parliament substantial grants for the renewal of active war. An ambitious strategy was adopted. The Black Prince would advance northward from the English territories of Gascony and Aquitaine towards the Loire. His younger brother, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, struck in from Brittany. The two forces were to join for a main decision. But all this miscarried, and the Black Prince found himself, with forces shrunk to about 4,000 men, of whom, however, nearly a half were the dreaded archers, forced to retire with growing urgency before the advance of a French royal army 20,000 strong. So grim were his straits that he proposed, as an accommodation, that he and the army should be allowed to escape to England. These terms were rejected by the French, who once again saw their deeply hated foe in their grasp. At Poitiers, the prince was brought to bay. Even on the morning of his victory, his vanguard was already marching southwards in retreat. But King John of France was resolved to avenge Crecy and finish the war at a stroke. Forced against all reason and all odds to fight, the haggard band of English marauders who'd carried pillage and arson far and wide were drawn up in an array and position chosen by consummate insight. The flanks were secured by forests. The archers lined a hedgerow and commanded the only practicable passage. 10 years had passed since Crecy, and the French chivalry and high command alike had brooded upon the tyranny of that event. They'd been forced to accept the fact that horses could not face the arrow storm. King Edward had won with an army entirely dismounted. The confusion wrought by English archery in a charging line of horses collapsing or driven mad through pain was, they realized, fatal to the old forms of warfare. King John was certain that all must attack on foot, and he trusted to overwhelming numbers. But the great merit of the Black Prince is that he did not rest upon the lessons of the past or prepare himself to repeat the triumphs of a former battle. He understood that the masses of mail-clad footmen who now advanced upon him in such towering numbers would not be stopped as easily as the horses. Archery alone, however good the target, would not save him. He must try the battle of manoeuvre and counter-attack. He therefore did the opposite to what military convention, based upon the then-known facts, would have pronounced right. The French nobility left their horses in the rear. The Black Prince had all his knights mounted. A deadly toll was taken by the archers upon the whole front. The French chivalry, encumbered by their mail, plodded ponderously forward amid vineyards and scrub. Many fell before the arrows, but the arrows would not have been enough at the crisis. It was the English spear and axemen who charged in the old style upon the ranks disordered by their fatigue of movement and the accidents of the ground. At the same time, in admirable concert, a strong detachment of mounted knights, riding round the French left flank, struck in upon the harassed and already disordered attack. The result was a slaughter as large and a victory as complete as Crecy, but with even greater gains. The whole French army was driven into ruin. King John and the flower of his nobility were captured or slain. The pillage of the field could not be gathered by the victors. They were already overburdened with the loot of 4 provinces. The Black Prince, whose record is dinted by many cruel acts of war, showed himself a paladin of the age when, in spite of the weariness and stresses of the desperate battle, he treated the captured monarch with all the ceremony of his rank, seated him in his own chair in the camp, and served him in person with such fare as was procurable. Thus, by genius, valour, and chivalry, he presents himself in a posture which history has not failed to salute. King John was carried to London. Like King David of Scotland before him, he was placed in the Tower, and upon this personal trophy, in May 1360, the Treaty of Bretigny was concluded. By this, England acquired, in addition to her old possession of Gascony, the whole of Henry II's possessions in Aquitaine in full sovereignty, Edward I's inheritance of Ponthieu, and the famous port and city of Calais, which last was held for nearly 200 years. A ransom was fixed for King John at 3 million gold crowns, the equivalent of £500,000 sterling. This was 8 times the annual revenue of the English crown in time of peace. At Crecy, France had been beaten on horseback. At Poitiers, she was beaten on foot. These two terrible experiments against the English bit deep into French thought. A sense of hopelessness overwhelmed the French court and army. How could these people be beaten or withstood? A similar phase of despair had swept across Europe a century earlier, after the menacing battles of the Mongol invasions. But, as has been wisely observed, the trees do not grow up to the sky. For a long spell the French avoided battles. They became as careful in fighting the England of King Edward III as in the days of Marlborough they fought the England of Queen Anne. A great French hero appeared in Bertrand de Guesclin, who, like Fabius Cunctator against Hannibal, by refusing battle and acting through sieges and surprises, rallied the factor of time to the home side. The triumph and the exhaustion of England were simultaneously complete. It was proved that the French army could not beat the English, and at the same time that England could not conquer France. The main effort of Edward III, though crowned with all military laurels, had failed. The years of the war with France are important in the history of Parliament. The need for money drove the Crown and its officials to summoning it frequently. This led to rapid and important developments. One of the main functions of the representatives of the shires and boroughs was to petition for the redress of grievances, local and national, and to draw the attention of the King and his council to urgent matters. The stress of war forced the government to take notice of these petitions of the Commons of England, and during the reign of Edward III, the procedure of collective petition, which had started under Edward II, made progress. The fact that the Commons now petitioned as a body in a formal way, and asked, as they did in 1327, that these petitions should be transformed into parliamentary statutes, distinguishes the lower house from the rest of Parliament. Under Edward I, the Commons were not an essential element in Parliament. But under Edward III, they assumed a position distinct, vital, and permanent. They had their own clerk, who drafted their petitions and their rejoinders to the Crown's replies. The separation of the Houses now appears. The Lords had come to regard themselves not only as natural councillors of the Crown, but as enjoying the right of separate consultation within the framework of Parliament itself. In 1343, the prelates and magnates met in the White Chamber at Westminster. The knights and burgesses adjourned to the Painted Chamber to discuss the business of the day. Here, in this Parliament, for the first time, the figure of a Speaker emerges. He was not on this occasion a member of the House, and for some time to come, the Commons generally spoke through an appointed deputation. But by the end of the reign, the role of the Speaker was recognised, and the Crown became anxious to secure its own nominees for this important and prominent office. The concessions made by Edward III to the Commons mark a decisive stage. He consented that all aids should be granted only in Parliament. He accepted the formal drafts of the Commons' collective petitions as the preliminary basis for future statutes, and by the time of his death it was recognised that the Commons had assumed a leading part in the granting of taxes and the presentation of petitions. Naturally, the Commons stood in awe of the Crown. There was no long tradition of authority behind them. The assertions of the royal prerogative in the days of Edward I still echoed in their minds, and there was no suggestion that either they, or Parliament as a whole, had any right of control or interference in matters of administration and government. They were summoned to endorse political settlements, reached often by violence, to vote money, and to voice grievances. But the permanent acceptance of Parliament as an essential part of the machinery of government, and of the Commons as its vital foundation, is the lasting work of the 14th century. Against papal agents, feeling was strong. The interventions of Rome in the days of John, the submissiveness of Henry III to the Church, the exactions of the papal tax collectors, the weight of clerical influence within the household and the council, all contributed to the growing criticism and dislike of the Church in England. The reign of Edward III brought the climax of this mood. The war with France had stimulated and embittered national sentiment, which resented the influence of an external institution whose great days were already passing. Moreover, this declining power had perforce abandoned its sacred traditional seat in Rome, and was now installed under French influence in enemy territory at Avignon. During these years, Parliament passed statutes forbidding appeals to be carried to the papal curia for matters cognizable in the royal courts, and restricting its power to make appointments in the Church of England. It is true that these statutes were only fitfully enforced, as dictated by diplomatic demands, but the drain of war left little money for Rome, and the papal tax collectors gleaned the country to little avail during the greater part of the reign. The renewal in 1369 of serious fighting in Aquitaine found England exhausted and disillusioned. The clergy claimed exemption from taxation, though not always successfully, and they could often flaunt their wealth in the teeth of poverty and economic dislocation. Churchmen were ousting the nobility from public office, and anti-clerical feeling grew in Parliament. The king was old and failing, and a resurgence of baronial power was due. John of Gaunt set himself to redress the balance in favour of the Lords by a carefully planned political campaign against the Church. Ready to his hand lay an unexpected weapon. In the University of Oxford, the national centre of theological study and learning, criticism of papal pretensions and power raised its voice. The arguments for reform set forth by a distinguished Oxford scholar named Wycliffe attracted attention. Wycliffe was indignant at the corruption of the Church, and saw in its proud hierarchy and absolute claims a distortion of the true principles of Christianity. He declared that dominion over men's souls had never been delegated to mortals. The king, as the vicar of God in things temporal, was as much bound by his office to curb the material lavishness of the clergy as the clergy to direct the spiritual life of the king. Though pope and king was each in his sphere supreme, every Christian held not in chief of them, but rather of God. The final appeal was to heaven, not to Rome. Wycliffe's doctrine could not remain the speculation of a harmless schoolman. Its application to the existing facts of church and state opened deep rifts. It involved reducing the powers of the church temporal in order to purify the church spiritual. John of Gaunt was interested in the first, Wycliffe in the second. The church was opposed to both. Gaunt and Wycliffe in the beginning each hoped to use the other for his special aim. They entered into an alliance. Gaunt busied himself in packing the new parliament, and Wycliffe lent moral support by running about from church to church preaching against abuses. But counter-forces were also aroused. Wycliffe's hopes of church reform were soon involved in class and party prejudices, and Gaunt, by his alliance with a revolutionary theologian, consolidated the vested interest of the episcopate against himself. Thus both suffered from their union. The bishops, recognizing in Wycliffe Gaunt's most dangerous supporter, arraigned him on charges of heresy at St. Paul's. Gaunt, coming to his aid, encountered the hostility of the London mob. The ill-matched partnership fell to pieces, and Wycliffe ceased to count in high politics. It was at this same point that his enduring influence began. He resolved to appeal to the people. Church abuses and his own reforming doctrines had attracted many young students around him. He organized his followers into bands of poor preachers who, like those of Wesley in a later century, spread the doctrines of poverty and holiness for the clergy throughout the countryside. He wrote English tracts, of which the most famous was The Wicket, which were passed from hand to hand. Finally, with his students, he took the tremendous step of having the Bible translated into English. Christen men and women, olde and younge, shouldn study fast in the Newe Testament, for it is of full authority and open to understanding of simple men, as to the pointes that be most needful to salvation. Each place of holy writ, both open and dark, teacheth meekness and charity, And therefore he that keepeth meekness and charity hath the true understanding and perfection of all holy writ. Therefore no simple man of wit be affaired unmiserably to study in the text of holy writ, and no clerk be proudy of the very understanding of holy writ. For why understanding of holy writ withouten charity that keepeth God's beasties maketh a man deeper damned, and pride and covetise of clerkes is cause of her blindness and heresy, and priveth them from very understanding of holy writ. The spirit of early Christianity now revived the English countryside with a keen, refreshing breeze after the weariness of sultry days. But the new vision, open to rich and poor alike, profoundly disturbed the decaying society to which it was vouchsafed. The powers of church and state were soon to realize their danger. The long reign had reached its dusk. The glories of Crecy and Poitiers had faded. The warlike king, whose ruling passions were power and fame, who had been willing to barter many prerogatives for which his ancestors had striven in order to obtain money for foreign adventure, was now in old age a debtor to time and fortune. Harsh were the suits they laid against him. He saw the wide conquests which his sword and his son had made in France melt like snow at Easter. A few coastal towns alone attested the splendour of victories long to be cherished in the memories of the island race. Queen Philippa, his loving wife, had died of plague in 1369. Even before her death, the old king had fallen under the consoling thrall of Alice Perrers, a lady of indifferent extraction, but of remarkable wit and capacity, untrammelled by scruple or by prudence. The spectacle of the famous king in his 60s, infatuated by an illicit love, jarred upon the haggard yet touchy temper of the times. Here was something less romantic than the courtly love that had been symbolized in 1348 by the founding of the Order of the Garter. Nobles and people alike would not extend to the mistress of the king's old age the benefits of the commanding motto of the order, On y soit qui mal y pense. Alice not only enriched herself with the spoils of favour, and decked herself in some at least of the jewels of Queen Philippa, but played high politics with lively zest. She even took her seat with the judges on the bench trying cases in which she was concerned. The movement of the nobility and the commons was therefore united against her. The king, at length worn down by war, business, and pleasure, subsided into senility. He had reached the allotted span. He celebrated the jubilee of his reign. The last decade was disparaging to his repute. Apart from Alice, he concentrated his remaining hopes upon the Black Prince. But this great soldier, renowned throughout Europe, was also brought low by the fatigues of war and was sinking fast in health. In 1376, the Black Prince expired, leaving a son not 10 years old as his heir apparent to the throne. King Edward III's large share of life narrowed sharply at its end. Mortally stricken,